From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, One Nation Under Dog, we talk with journalist and dog owner Michael Schaefer about how dogs have worked their way into a new place in the hearts, homes, and wallets of their owners. His new book is about pet ownership in an era of dog park politics, organic pet food, pet health insurance, and a whole service industry of groomers, trainers, and caretakers. And Schaefer will tell us about some of the dilemmas he's faced with his own dog, like what to do when his dog had separation anxiety each day as Schaefer went to work, and the dog howled for hours until he returned. It's a story that ends with antidepressants for the dog. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, where you can choose from up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com. From Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at AngiesList.com. And from Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Progressive Automotive X Prize, a race to develop cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. Now, that's progressive.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Michael Schaefer and his wife rescued a sweet, cuddly, and goofy St. Bernard from a shelter, it led him into the world of contemporary pet ownership, a world of doggy antidepressants, dog park politics, dog furniture, organic pet food, and a whole service industry of grooming, training, and caretaking. In Schaefer's new book, One Nation Under Dog, he says America's house pets have worked their way into a new place in the hearts, homes, and wallets of their owners. Schaefer is a journalist who is a former staff writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, U.S. News and World Report, and the Washington City Paper. He's also written for Slate and the New Republic. Michael Schaefer, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I don't want people to think that your book mocks people who love their animals and mocks people who spend money on their animals. But you do take a look at that phenomenon. So what are you trying to get at in the book?
Well, I guess I wanted to sit down and write a book about how it is that we became this pampered pet nation. You kind of can't go a week or two reading a newspaper without seeing some crazy story about what people do for their animals. You know, it's the dog with the pink mohair sweater, or look at these people. They feed organic cat food. And these stories tend to have a kind of undercurrent of derision in them. You know, this is a sign of frivolity and over-the-top excess, particularly in these dark economic times, this is out of place. And I felt that way when I got a dog. My wife and I remember we were driving to this shelter where we knew this dog we wanted was available. And we were driving, it was about 2.5 hours from our house. And the whole way up, we were talking about how, well, we're not going to become like those people, the ones that we had heard about. And we were saying, you know, we're not going to do this, and we're not going to do this, and we're not going to do this. And, of course, then the dog arrives, and all of that goes out the window. And it doesn't go out the window because he's so cute and melts your heart, although that helps. It goes out the window because a lot of the stuff people do for their pets now is just an inevitable reaction or reflection of the society we live in.
Let me ask you to give an example, and here's the one I'm thinking of. A lot of people make fun of animals who are taking things like antidepressants.
Right.
Your dog on antidepressants. Right. Because of what?
Well, we had jobs, and we had this dog at home. And we live in a little row house in Philadelphia, and our next-door neighbors are retired, and they're home all day. And one night they came to us and said, you know, that dog of yours yaps from the minute you guys leave in the morning till the minute you guys come home. And this was a time when he would also go to the bathroom in the house when we left. We would take turns rushing home at lunch, you know, hoping to head it off, which didn't usually work. And, you know, he was quite clearly in distress. And, you know, I mentioned this to the vet kind of in passing, more thinking, hey, do you have any, you know, behavior type techniques I could do to help him relax? And the vet said, you know, there's a drug for that. It's called separation anxiety. That's the condition he's got. And there is a canine version of a human tricyclic antidepressant. The only actual chemical difference is that the pills are beef flavored. And, you know, this was this thing my in-laws, my uncles were saying, you know, you're giving your dog antidepressants? I mean, what's the matter with this country where even our dogs are on antidepressants? Aren't they supposed to be the happiest creatures in the world? And, you know, I guess if you step back and look at it that way, it seems kind of silly. But as a very practical matter, we should all be so lucky as to have had the positive effect he had from the medication. And, you know, we're at a time when we humans are quite comfortable with psychopharmaceuticals. There was, maybe I shouldn't say this, but there was a time when, you know, all three members of our household were using some sort of antidepressant. Now he's the only one. But you know, it is all just to say that we humans are quite comfortable with this. Lots of people do it. It's not weird. It doesn't mean you're crazy. And as you see this with a lot of things in the pet spending world, where things that we experience and kind of think of as normal, we will go and ask, hey, can I do that for my dog or my cat?
But as you point out in your book, putting your dog on antidepressants because of separation anxiety, mm-hmm. his separation anxiety, mm-hmm. is a reflection on how humans live now.
Absolutely.
I mean, there used to be a time when a family that had a dog typically had a mother homemaker who was there all day, right. who was there with the dog, or there were kids of different ages, and there was a young kid at home to play with the dog. There was a yard that the dog could run around in. And now you've got dogs cooped up at home with nobody home to play them, nothing to play with them, nothing to occupy them. And so it puts the dog in a position of great discomfort because they have no activity and no company.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, I write in my book that an anthropologist from Mars or something that showed up here and had only the contents of like a PetSmart to look at could figure out a great deal about our human society.
What would they learn?
They would learn, among others. I mean, they, looking at just this question, they would learn that we are a society where two career couples are the norm in a lot of places. And that has led to a whole bunch of things. It's led to more dogs being alone more of the time. It's led to these very elaborate chew toys that I write about, where you know these toys are basically designed to keep the pet entertained during these very long absences of its people, and they have all of these devices to kind of make it complicated to get a piece of food out from the middle, and the idea is that a dog, you know, with this toy thrown to him in the morning as the owner heads off for the day, will actually spend a couple of hours trying to manipulate it and chew on it in a certain way that makes the food pop out and so on. And at the end of that, the dog will be exhausted. He'll be mentally stimulated, which is great on a theoretical level. He also won't spend the rest of the day destroying your couch, which has a more practical benefit for humans. So people still want pets. They want them, I think, more than they ever did. And they are adjusting the nature of pet keeping in such ways as to reflect the other aspects of how we live.
And that's part of the reason why a whole pet services industry, a huge pet services
right.
industry has grown
right.
up.
Right.
Give us an overview of some of the services available for pets now.
Well, you can find some really crazy examples of wealth and excess in pet services, and you can also find some very practical things.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a day driving around Manhattan with this pet taxi driver, and his company would take calls from people saying, you know, I need to take my dog to the vet. Manhattan's a place where a lot of people don't have cars, and you can't just take any old pet on the subway, and a lot of cabs won't stop for you. So it's actually a practical need that was being filled. And people would pay, you know, $31 for this trip, $42 for that trip. It was a Friday. At the end of the day, people were going out to the Hamptons, similarly being driven out with their dogs. For them, they've decided that for the dog owners, they had decided it was kind of the cost of doing business, the cost of owning a pet in their world.
A typical service that a lot of people use now is dog walking.
Right.
Because of what we were talking about before.
Right.
So someone is a single person or both people in the household work, and the dog needs to be walked.
Right.
Or you're leaving town for a couple of days.
Right. And as a full-time job, this has grown tremendously. There mm-hmm. are a couple of dueling dog walker professional associations which offer certifications and a kind of guarantee that this person you're hiring is not going to steal your steal your dog or anything else from your house. And it's, you know, it's not that expensive, $15, $20, depending on where you are. And a lot of people have decided that, boy, having a pet brings me so much joy that spending, you know, $15 every weekday so because I have to work 10-hour days is worth it for me. There's also this incredibly fast-growing business of professional dog grooming. And, you know, to me, it is connected fairly intimately with this change in where people's pets have lived, literally lived, over the years. In the old days, it was pretty common to have your dog especially sleep out back for the night in the doghouse or out in the yard. I actually saw an article in a business journal that sort of traced images of dogs in advertisements in women's magazines over the course of the 20th century. And in the 1920s, the sort of prototypical picture would be of a stylish woman out on the street walking her dog in public. And by the 50s, you'd have the dog kind of curled up on the hearth in the living room. And by the 80s and 90s, you had this image of, you know, like an aspirin ad where the mom is supplying medicine to the sick child and the dog is literally on the child's bed. So it's this kind of progression indoors and into the family and into the bedroom. I don't think it's any surprise, given that I think I saw a statistic that said 47% of people have their pet sleep in their own bed. I don't think it's any surprise given
sleep that. Sleep in the people's bed.
Sleep in the people's bed. I don't think it's any surprise given that those people are going to be a lot more interested in getting their dog groomed because you don't want to sleep with a stinky dog.
In talking about services, one of the services that you've both researched and taken advantage of is pet hotels, those the more high-end kennels that you can board an animal in if you're going away. Give us a sense of the range of things that you've seen in looking at the high and low range kennels that are available.
Well, for a lot of people, if they go out of town, the easiest thing to do is they just go to their vet, and the vet will have a few kennels, and the dog can stay there. This used to be pretty standard. To a lot of people, it's now thought of as kind of cruel, and that, you know, it'll be in some dank room in the vet's office and these mom-and-pop vets. And you have seen this tremendous proliferation of pet hotels. And the biggest of the pet stores, PetSmart and I believe Petco, are getting into this business as well because it's growing very fast. But I saw it, and I visited a place in San Francisco called the WAG Hotel, where there are several types of rooms you can choose from, but the largest and most lavish of them have TVs and, you know, beds and a video camera that lets the owner, who was presumably on vacation someplace, log on and actually look at their
webcam.
A webcam, right. And then the owner can then call the hotel or email and say, boy, you know, my dog looks hungry. Can you please bring him a treat? And, of course, that costs extra. But this place cost, I believe, $85 a night, which is, you know,
significant.
more than a lot of Motel 6s.
Yeah. So you've put your dog up in a hotel?
I have. I've put him up in a hotel for, you know, when we went on vacation. I also once took him with me to one of the many human hotels that have become pet friendly.
Right, and they have room service menus with with the dog and cat food.
And this was something. This was a case where I really wanted to go experience the most lavish, over the top thing I could imagine. And we went to the Regency in Manhattan, which had been advertised quite extensively as pet friendly, and it sure was. And we got there, and there was a doggy bed in the room. They brought a bowl of doggy biscuits. We were able to pay for having a hotel staffer, liveried staffer, out walking the dog for us when we went out to dinner. They had in-room babysitting for the dog in case you felt the dog would be distressed by being left alone. And it was really something. The joke of it was our dog didn't much like it. He was unaccustomed to having this hallway right outside the door where people were walking by. Even in a very nice hotel with carpeting, and it's not a cheap place where you actually hear the people in the hallway. He was able to hear them and didn't much like that.
You got your dog from a shelter, and that's I think for a lot of people the preferred way of getting a pet, because you get to rescue an animal that's been abandoned or was homeless. How are shelters changing?
You know, the world of where pets come from stands at great contrast to the rest of the pet industry. There are professional market research types who can tell you exactly how many brands of high-end pet shampoo came on the market in the year 2006, for instance. But people have only a relatively foggy idea of where pets come from, how many of them come from so-called puppy mills, how many of them are purchased in stores, how many of them come from rescues or breeders or what have you. But one of the phenomena of recent years, which is related to this campaign against cruel puppy mills that mass breed puppies in often inhumane conditions, has been that the shelters themselves and the advocates for adoption are trying to compete on a kind of market level. So you have, in the old days, you would have to go to the Pound, which was often in a bad part of town, and it was a miserable place where all these dogs are howling, and you know that the ones you don't pick are going to be euthanized, and if you're with your kid's going to start crying, and it's going to be a very unhappy and stressful day for everyone. Instead, I went to a place in Chicago called Paws, which might have been the most beautiful space I set foot in that entire week. It was like a Restoration Hardware or something. It was a beautiful retail environment. It had enormous bay windows, so the sun kind of dappled in, and they had arranged the dogs' rooms in such a way as that there were no sight lines from one dog to another, which is something that causes howling. So there wasn't this kind of cacophony of unhappy howls. One of the employees who was taking me around, you know, at one point she said we were in the cat adoption area, and she said, "Well, you see the walls in here? They're kind of a more Ralph Lauren-y color." You know, and I sort of looked at her and thought, you know, you're a person who's dedicated your life to this really tough issue of rescuing pets that might be killed otherwise. And we're sitting here talking about Ralph Lauren colors and which color is most flattering to a cat. The experience there is so pleasant. I mean, this is the argument, is that you make the experience pleasant, make it retail, make it customer friendly, people will be more eager to adopt pets rather than to buy them in ways that often abet a really cruel system.
My guest is journalist Michael Schaefer. He's the author of the new book, One Nation Under Dog. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Michael Schaefer, and his new book is called One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. You found your dog, Murphy, initially from a website, which is how a lot of people are finding animals now. Right. And so what attracted you to your dog? I mean, it's kind of like online dating or something, you know, you're looking at all these pictures and you're thinking, how does that person look? Well, how did you decide this was your dog based on what you saw on the web?
You know, it's another way adoption has changed, is that you used to have to go down to the pound and you'd kind of take what was there. And if you lived in a city like Philadelphia, where I live, what was there would be a lot of pit bulls, a lot of dogs that rightly or wrongly have a reputation as being tough and something you might not want. And there's this website called Pet Finder, which, you know, it kind of works like Amazon.com. You can call up whatever it is you particularly want, and it will show you all of the animals at shelters in whatever range of miles away from your house you are willing to travel that need adoption. For me, I never had pets before. I never had a dog before, and I was always attracted to those dogs that have sort of droopy, jowly faces because I thought they were really cute. There really wasn't a great deal more thought to it than that. The idea of having, and we wound up with Murphy, who is a Saint Bernard. He's not just any drooly dog. He's a very, very, very big drooly dog. And I don't know why that particular face managed to woo me, but that was what I wanted. And it was mostly just sort of messing around. I would type in, you know, I'd go to this website and type in, oh, hey, what about bloodhounds? You know, they're kind of cool looking, and I didn't know anything about their behavior or temperament or whatever. And then I typed in St. Bernard, and there was a picture of Murphy. And it said in the text that accompanied it that he was unusually small for a St. Bernard, which was good because I lived in a pretty small house. And, you know, my wife and I had been talking about getting a dog, and we said, how about this one? And we drove out and took a look and wound up bringing him home.
There's a funny chapter in your book where you're trying to decide whether the dog will adapt to living with you. Right. And you're giving all these doggy tests to him that you've read. And your wife is reading out loud from the book, explaining what you're supposed to do to test the dog. Tell us what you did to administer a test to see if the dog would fit in at home with you.
Right. Well, as with any other aspect of pet ownership, there are endless sources of advice, and they're often quite contradictory. Mm-hmm. We wound up with this book about how to adopt a dog from a shelter, and it warned us. It said, listen, you know, the shelter owners, often for very good reasons, very noble reasons, will try to tell you a sob story, and the whole purpose of this is to make you overcome your skepticism and take this dog home, but you should really be tough and think about what dog is going to work with you. And it had some ideas, you know, one of them was, well, you were supposed to, we didn't actually do it right, but you're supposed to take a sort of phony hand on the end of a stick. And you'll put some food in front of the dog and then push the dog's face away from the food with this phony hand. And if the dog nips at the hand, well, that's a very bad sign. I did it with a real hand, which apparently was, you know, taking my life, or at least my hand, into my hands. But we were trying to sort of assess whether this dog's temperament and mood and everything was going to be all right, because neither of us really knew a great deal about what we were getting into. Neither of us had a huge amount of time. And so we were concerned about having something that was going to be a real problem for us. And the woman who ran the shelter was just, you know, sitting there sort of chuckling at us, because she thought we were these, you know, typical neurotic city people who'd come out to the shelter. She eventually took us aside and said, listen, you know, I don't really know you or care about you, but I do care about him. And if he goes and bites someone, you'll probably put him down, and I don't want that to happen. So I'm going to tell you right now, he doesn't bite. And, you know, it was good enough for us.
Michael Schaefer will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called One Nation Under Dog. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, dog park etiquette and politics, and how conflicting approaches to dog training are like the culture wars. We continue our conversation with Michael Schaefer, author of One Nation Under Dog.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, opening a digital and print photography space in Los Angeles at annenbergspaceforphotography.org. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Michael Schaefer, author of the new book, One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. Schaefer was led into this world after adopting a St. Bernard named Murphy from a shelter. Schaefer is a former staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and U.S. News & World Report. He's also written for The New Republic and Slate. I know that there are dog parks in most cities. Do you have a dog park to take Murphy to?
Not officially. In my neighborhood, there's, but it's interesting you ask that, because when we got Murphy and began taking him to this park in the neighborhood where everybody takes their dogs, you know, it was like I was Margaret Mead and it just landed in Samoa. There was this this very intricate network of rules and what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. And no one wrote them down, no one told you them, but you just sort of figured them out. And you could see how the people who were regulars at the park would, you know, shun people who engaged in behavior that wasn't cool remind you of what you're supposed to do. You know, heaven forbid that you let your dog poop and don't pick it up, because everyone will remind you. But there's other types of things which, as I went around, I visited a lot of dog parks, there's great variation among dog parks, and even these informal ones, in terms of what is permitted and what isn't. And I'm not, again, talking about a written list of rules.
Give me an example.
Well, in my neighborhood, I live in a sort of college-y neighborhood right by a university. And one thing dogs do in dog parks is they hump. And, you know, most of the time people have a kind of dogs will be dogs attitude. Well, you know, that's what they do. They're dogs. And, you know, sometimes if there's a new person, people will try to get their dog to not do that because they don't know how the new person will react. But that tends to be how it works. There's another very nice, actually legal, official dog park in a kind of ritzy part of town that we take our dog to sometimes. And there, it's really not okay. And there, again, there's no sign that says no humping. But you can tell from the way everyone else is reacting that when Murphy is mounting another dog, that it's not at all acceptable, and they really don't like that, and they don't know who you are, and they kind of want you to go away.
So are you a regular now at the dog park? You know all the rules?
I'm a regular there, not because I know all the rules, but because it's the closest thing to my house.
Right, right. Okay.
And it's actually been a place where, you know, I spend an hour a day there, and I've made a lot of friends. And one of our closest friends in our city is someone we met through the park. And I think this is quite typical, this idea of...
That's a point you make in your book, that dogs are a way of connecting to other people in addition to having a connection to the dogs, and in a society where we're growing increasingly isolated.
Right, and this is something that's been the subject of a certain amount of scholarly research, but it's something I've also sort of experienced in my own life at my neighborhood dog park. And I've also sort of seen it in action, and I've written about some of the business people who are trying to take advantage of it. In Austin, Texas, I remember visiting a bar that had a yappy hour, I believe, every Wednesday or Thursday night. And it was a great idea. I mean, whoever thought of it.
Wait, you bring your pet with you?
Bring your pet with you. And you know, it was outdoors, and they had put out some dog bowls, and probably a quiet night of the week. And it was a great way of drumming up business. The people who were there loved it, because for them, you know, having to rush home from work every day and walk the dog, while a pleasure, also, you know, sort of impeded on their social life a little bit. And this was a way to combine the two. And as ornate as a lot of city dog parks may be now, very few of them serve beer.
You know, you mentioned earlier that more people seem to have pets now than ever before. If that's true, have you thought about the reasons why that might be true?
The most convincing of the reasons I've heard, and I can't claim to have come up with it myself, traces the point where the growth of the pet population began to grow faster than the human population to the 1960s, late 60s. And the argument is that this is the same time when we began moving further from families and more divorce and people leaving tight-knit urban neighborhoods in favor of a more isolated suburban lifestyle, and a kind of broad array of social support mechanisms going away. And that one thing people did was turn to pets to help fill that void. And I think it also explains the role that pets were given in this new world, that they were considered much more as full-fledged members of the family with all of our obligations to them than in the old days. If you walk through a pet cemetery, you know, you can kind of see this in real time. Some of the very old graves are likely to say or liable to say, you know, here lies Fido, a loyal servant. And newer ones you'll find, you know, here lies Fido, my best friend. Or often, and there are all these internet sites where people can write tributes to their recently deceased pets, and it'll say, my baby, or Fido was my child, except that his name is not so likely to be Fido anymore. I actually saw some statistics from a pet insurance company about what the most common names of policyholders was, and it was like Max and Jake and Chloe and Julie, which are also pretty common names for babies nowadays.
What does that say to you that more people seem to be giving their pets human names instead of, you know, Fido and Spot?
I think there is this idea of humanization and of this kind of promotion of pets to being junior humans, being members of the family. And it explains, I mean, from the marketing point of view, the people who have businesses selling, you know, chew toys or nights at doggy day spas or whatever, it's great for them. For us, I think, you know, I think it's actually kind of a sweet thing because I think it speaks to this desire people have to embrace pets, to take them into their lives and into their hearts. And it actually, you know, for all of us, it's kind of nice to be needed. And this idea that their pet really needs them, relies on them, is a pretty huge thing for a lot of people. There was a public health campaign run by, I think, the San Francisco City Health Department. And it's a website. It's called Dogs Are Talking. And the argument at this, it's an anti-STD campaign. It's encouraging people to go get tested for syphilis. And dogs, you know, don't have anything to do with syphilis. The argument is, look, if you have a dog and you get sick, you know, your dog is going to need you and you're not going to be able to provide for it. And this is kind of playing on that urge to provide and to nurture and using that urge to encourage what the public health people think is better behavior.
My guest is journalist Michael Schaefer, author of the new book, One Nation Under Dog. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Michael Schaefer, and he's the author of the new book, One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. You have a chapter on basically dog training culture wars. You compare two different styles
right.
of dog training. And what are the different styles and what do they tell you about our culture today?
Right. Well, there is the number of, according to the federal government, the number of animal trainers in the country tripled in just 6 years between 2000 and 2006. And, you know, one of the reasons for this is as I said, that getting dog training has become, for a lot of middle-class pet owners, a kind of basic, normal, responsible thing you do to be a good citizen. And there has been this wildly popular and really good TV show called The Dog Whisperer, starring Cesar Millan. Which is like a weekly advertisement for the concept of dog training. You see him go, you know, you might imagine hiring a dog trainer is something that only, you know, absurdly rich people do, or you only do if you want to train a seeing eye dog or a stunt dog or something. And that's how it used to be, or at least you'd only do if you had kind of a problem dog. And, you know, watching The Dog Whisperer, you actually see him go into these houses of perfectly normal people. And granted, normal people whose dogs are acting in ways they don't want, but people who are not fancy spendthrift types. The thing is, though, that this growth of this industry has masked or hasn't made up for the fact that there are wildly divergent views about what the most effective and most humane way to train a dog is. For most of the 20th century, since the sort of dawn of kind of modern dog training, which was geared, again, towards police dogs and Hollywood dogs and whatever, it was this very rote military-style training. Actually, the first prominent dog trainer was in the Prussian police force. So you can imagine it was sort of in his image, and it was if the dog, you know, doesn't behave in the right way, jerk its chain. And that idea kind of carried through most of the 20th century. There was this pedagogical revolution in the 70s and 80s among trainers who thought, hey, maybe actually positive reinforcement, you know, hitting him with a reward as quickly as possible after he does something well is a more effective way to train. The argument was that dogs are too dumb to figure out why it is you're kicking them. So if you were trying to correct some bad behavior, it's difficult to do that through these purely negative ways. At this positive reinforcement model kind of became the standard among professionals, and academically based professionals as well as trainers and who might hang out a shingle and so on, until Caesar's show went on the air. And his idea is quite different. It's that, you know, there is this natural order of things as existed in a pack of wild wolves where the alpha dog was the boss and the other dogs were subordinate. And his idea is the way you the problem for American dogs, the problem with their behavior is that we have lost touch with the natural order of things. And that the way to shape a dog's behavior is to remind it that you, the human, are its alpha. Which seems good in theory, but to a lot of the positive trainers, the ways he gets to that are considered cruel or at least impractical. And they see all this sort of talk about nature as just a mask for a return to this old-fashioned, dominant, top-down model. And to my mind, it all plays out kind of like a version of the culture wars over how to raise a kid. You know, we've got one side based in institutions and universities that has a softer, more positive approach. You have another side that says our society has gone amiss because we've lost our discipline and lost our sense of authority. And, you know, it sounds awfully familiar.
Which approach did you go with your training?
We hired a woman who, because we didn't know anything about this, hired a woman who had a good website and we liked her a lot, who had a kind of alpha approach. And it was this, you know, when you go through a door, you go first. Murphy doesn't go first. That way
you got to teach him who's boss.
Right. And when you come home, don't pet him. Once he has calmed down, call him over to the couch and then pet him. And she was we really like her. And she, you know, things I'm saying may, you know, sort of removed from the experience might sound kind of monstrous, but the argument was this is what will make him feel better, that, you know, any behavior problems he has have to do with anxiety over who's the boss, and that dogs, unlike humans, are not sitting around scheming, hoping to become the boss, but that what they do need is a secure sense of where they are in the order of things. So it was, you know, put out his food for exactly 20 minutes a day, then put it away. He has to know that he's going to eat on your schedule, not on his. And, you know, he doesn't get to come on the bed. And when you walk him, you know, hold the leash tight and he doesn't get to decide where you go and that sort of thing. And it, you know, it worked.
You started your book when times were much better economically than they were by the time you finished it.
Right.
And certainly by the time it was published. How do you think the economic mess that we're in is affecting what people are willing to buy for their pets?
You know, when I started the book, I had thought of it at least in part as a book about excess, and as a book about the manifestation of excess through the way people treat pets. And as I got into my research, I realized that wasn't what it was about at all. Pets, I think, are a pretty good reflection of the society at large, which includes a little bit of excess, but includes a lot of other things too. And it's a good thing I came to that conclusion because excess went rapidly out of style while I was working on this. And the pet industry seems to be, insofar as anyone can tell yet, surviving very nicely. One of the things I've written about, one of the constant themes in this book is this social promotion of pets to be like ersatz children, to be members of the family. Once you've received that promotion, it's very hard to be demoted by a mere economic catastrophe. People who had decided that they were going to buy, say, organic pet food for their dog, even the most deluded pet people don't think that's because the dog is a gourmand. they think it's because it is the basic nutritional thing that they owe them. They've decided that this is a nutritionally important thing to do, and they are going to stick with that and sacrifice for themselves while they do it. I went each of the years I was working on this, I would go to the Global Pet Expo, which is this massive, massive pet goods trade show. And you see, you know, glow-in-the-dark leashes and hamster mineral water and mental enrichment games for fish and all kinds of crazy stuff there. And each year that at that event, the Pet Trade Association rolls out its latest figures for what their economic performance was in the past year. And in 2008, they had done $41 billion of business the previous year and projected $43 billion in the year to come. When everyone got together in February of this year, there was a lot of trepidation and nervousness about what the numbers would show, and it turned out they had hit their $43 billion target for 08, they say, and they predicted $45 billion for the year ahead. And that also comports with what some of the business people I've gotten to know are telling me, that they think they're doing okay. Not growing as fast as they were, but they think they're doing all right.
At the same time, I read about people who abandon their animals when they are foreclosed on or can't afford their rent anymore.
Right. And I think one of the things the recession is showing is that there is a limit to the elasticity of people spending on their pets. It's one thing if you have a choice. You know, I'm going to scrimp on myself in order to keep buying this particularly worthy brand of food or this medication or what have you. But it's another thing to be hit with, say, a $8,000 veterinary bill. You just can't pay it, so you don't do the procedure. You don't have a choice. And similarly, if you've been foreclosed from your house and you have to go rent a place and the landlord won't take pets, you don't have a choice anymore. And people are in a very tough situation. Now, you can say that it also shows that there are limits to how much people will consider their pets a member of the family, because if your new landlord said, well, we can't take your kid, no one would give up the kid. But it is kind of the best of times and the worst of times. People are showing the intensity of this bond by sticking with it when they have a choice, but more people are now in a position where they don't have a choice.
Michael Schaefer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Schaefer is the author of the new book, One Nation Under Dog. This Friday on Fresh Air, we're going to feature our interview with Leonard Cohen. He's on his first performance tour in 15 years. A recording of his London concert from last July was just released on a double CD. Here's a track from it, Everybody Knows.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows that good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows baby, everybody knows you really do. Everybody knows you've been faithful, give or take a night or two.
Everybody. That's Leonard Cohen from his new CD, Live in London. We'll feature our interview with him Friday. This is Fresh Air. By now, music fans are used to the regular discovery of vintage, unreleased recordings. Nearly all of the good material is by already celebrated performers. But once in a great while, unknown players from the past make an impact on the present. Critic Milo Miles talks about one such release from the proto-punk trio Death.
In a pop market where you've got to pick up every niche, there's a relentless parade of long-lost masterpieces and forgotten gems. Can be psychedelic, rockabilly, soul, funk, or whatever. More and more, these are sad disappointments, or at best, trifles for zealous fans of the style who feast on crumbs. Quite a jolt, then, that the Detroit trio Death has come out with a brief album for the whole world to see. It's the most surprising and satisfying proto-punk discovery since the Monks' Black Monk time back in 1994. After all, the Monks had been a persistent rumor since the 1960s, with pictures of their tonsured heads turning up on occasion. Death were no more than a 1976 single, heard by almost no one. Back then, neither the market nor the audience were ready for the three Black Hackney brothers, guitarist David, bassist and singer Bobby, and drummer Dennis, who are wrapped up in rock and roll. Your face is sweaty and your eyes are red. The face of mine is steady. Roll yourself another stick of grass. The moon is inside and move your Why is Death such an anomaly? For the whole world to see consists of the single, plus five recently discovered 1974 demos. And most of the tracks evoke the hard-charging racket of the Stooges and the MC5, who are as much a part of the Detroit scene as Motown. Besides, 20 years before Death, in the era of Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, and Little Richard, rock and roll was too black, no matter who was performing it. After the British invasion, however, the image of a rock band changed to unconventional white guys with charming accents. By the end of the 60s, Jimi Hendrix was the only major black performer in rock, and even he caught criticism for not embracing racial revolution. Black rock and roll never really went away. There were heavy doses of it in the band Funkadelic, and there was the occasional offbeat group like Mother's Finest from Atlanta. It's clear that songwriters Bobby and David Hackney loved the very nature of high-energy rock. It was punchy, plain, said what it thought. Punky, in other words. And though punk now has a connotation of downbeat fury, that was not always so. Like the Ramones, Death were more jokey than angry. Death's big experimental number, Let the World Turn, even promotes cosmic patience and offers a reminder that, early on, party punks could also be arty punks.
Let the world turn, let the world turn around. Let the world turn, let the world turn around. On a wild trip around. Let the world turn, let the world turn around. On a wild trip, on a wild trip around.
Even in Detroit, death never got much radio exposure, and the Hackneys never connected with the right music industry people. The brothers went on to play gospel and eventually reggae. David Hackney died in 2000, more convinced than anyone else that death would get its due. For the whole world to see proves he was right. As rich and provocative as the 70s punk explosion was, it would have been more so if death had taken part.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Death's album For the Whole World to See on the Drag City label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
All you timeless children with your predictions and flashbacks, trying to get ahead. What makes you think I can see you? What makes you think I believe you? Dreams inside my head. Have you heard the family news? Stepping up willingly, shot, I come to pass. All the dreams are flying, all the thoughts are dying. Heard, it's running fast.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a doctor's reflections on illness in a high-tech era. We talk with Dr. Robert Martinson about some troubling aspects of the system he describes as a biomedical industrial complex. He's an emergency room physician, medical historian, and bioethicist, and the author of the new book, A Life Worth Living. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.